Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today I'm a little bit on location. I'm at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois, and I'm going to be talking today to a vision chemist. That's a chemist with vision, but also studies vision. And my guest today is Professor Beth Gilliard from the Department of Chemistry at Northern Illinois University. And Beth, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you, Keith. It's a pleasure to talk to you this morning. I'm glad that you could visit our department. And I'm happy to talk to you a little bit about vision chemistry.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's it's an area that we haven't covered much on Science Studio over the years. But before we get that, let's learn a little bit about Beth. How did you become a scientist? What were those formative years when all of a sudden it seemed this was going to be a career for you or an interest for you?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I was trying to roll some ideas around in my head. My father was a pilot in the U.S. Navy, and so as a little child, I remember him teaching me a lot of things that had to do with mechanics and science. He was very much a teacher father, and we used to go to air shows together, and I think I got an interest in science that way. And then we moved around a lot because of the military, and I was able to just see and do a lot of things. And I don't remember any time not sort of being in love with science.
Did you ever learn to fly? Was that part of your father's teaching? He said, come on, Beth, let's
go up.
Well,
interestingly, I'm in the process of completing my private pilot's license.
And what do you want to do when you've got your license?
I don't have any plans. Maybe somebody will hire me to be their private pilot.
Just
a lot of fun flying. And I'm originally from the northern Gulf Coast, and it's beautiful to fly down there. It's calm to fly over water. And a lot of my relatives fly also, so we have kind of a tradition in my family of flying.
Okay, so then there was a tradition. You had a father teacher. You thought science was cool. When did you actually decide, well, I'm going to go for this career in science, this degree, this PhD, and all that good stuff?
Well, I think when I went to college at Florida State University, I initially wanted to go as a pre-med student. But as soon as I took organic chemistry, I'm sure you've heard this from many people, I just fell in love, right?
Well, there's two responses to that. Some people, as soon as I hit organic chemistry, I thought physics major, all right? Or the other is fell in love with it, and so you fell in love with it
and became a chemistry major and got very involved in activities in the department there, and then went on to graduate school in Texas. So I'm a UT Austin alum.
Oh, that's good.
So it was very nice having another Texan here to talk
displaced,
to.
Displaced, but nevertheless,
well,
Texan.
I'm displaced too. So, and just, you know, chemistry is really a wonderful place to be in terms of science, at least in my opinion, because one of the best things about doing research in science is that you're having so much fun. There's nothing better in the world than learning how to understand nature and the world around you, and chemistry really kind of touches all those areas. I mean, chemists, we seem to be able to move between physics, biology, math, you know, all the different sciences. Chemistry is kind of in the middle.
Right. And then there's this big one, in this case, is the whole concept of vision. So let's talk about that for a little bit. You call yourself a vision chemist, or I called you a vision chemist. What does that mean?
Well, as a vision chemist, maybe I should back up and say I started out as a graduate student having a great deal of interest in photochemistry, so how light interacts with any kind of material, and in particular in biological systems. And the eye was kind of a natural place to study that interaction. There are not a lot of chemists who are involved. I guess most of my colleagues are very, very medically oriented. So maybe there are not a lot of chemists involved in this area, but we basically try to understand what happens in aging of the eye and eye diseases at the molecular level. You know, understanding how damage occurs to tissue, and once you understand how damage occurs, try to help develop protocols or changes in lifestyle that would help people to protect their vision.
I mean, that's difficult to think about for a moment, because most of us who don't think about the chemistry of vision just think of the eye as rather a bit of an instrument. It's got a lens, it's got a receiver, and so the chemistry, I mean, it's not easy to understand how one modifies that chemistry. So go into a little bit about, for the audience here, and I know we're talking about vision, but tell us about vision with words. How does the eye function, first of all?
Well, you have a very interesting point that a lot of times I'll bring that up to students that, yeah, our eye is a kind of a unique sensor. It's how we can interact with the world outside. I think the sense that people utilize the most for understanding the world around them is through sight. And the eye is really interesting because it's basically being continuously exposed to light and has a mechanism, or that there's a process in the eye that allows you to take the incoming light signals and convert them into an image that's eventually formed in the brain. But all of that entire process is controlled by chemical reactions. And as you can imagine, there are a lot of steps in those reactions. So if they're not very carefully controlled, things can go awry. There's some genetic disorders where that process breaks down. A lot of people have heard of retinitis pigmentosa as a genetic disease where people lose their vision.
And what's happening there? I mean, I'm not familiar with that particular disease.
With retinitis, well, I guess what's true in all of the disorders of the retina, which is the light-sensing part of the eye, the receptors that sense incoming light begin to deteriorate. And once they have deteriorated, then people will lose their vision.
So there's not a recurring regeneration of the retina that's normal. I mean, are you telling me?
Well, there is. Actually, the retina itself is very, very actively being rebuilt and remodeled, even on a daily basis.
Okay.
About every 10 days, our bodies will rebuild those sensors, the photoreceptors that allow us to detect light. What happens in these genetic disorders is that process, in one way or another, is dysfunctional. And so the tissue will ultimately die.
So the retina, in this case, is very different from the brain. I mean, one grows up thinking that you've got a certain number of brain cells, and slowly, day by day, they diminish in number until you're not very good at using your brain. But the eye is a different thing. A healthy eye can keep regenerating, in the case of the retina, ad nauseum.
Yes, in principle, you continue to remake those photoreceptors on a daily basis. As you age, you can think of it as, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it. So you have a set of steps that take you from A to B, and that's how you regenerate your photoreceptors. As you age or with disease, sometimes you step off of that pathway and make some mistakes. And so not everything is funneled towards producing the new photoreceptor. And it's this stepping off of the path, or what we might call byproducts of these chemical reactions, that often lead to disease and dysfunction of the tissue.
So let's talk then a little bit about some specific things that you, Beth, do in your research group. What are the chemical processes, in simple terms, that you're looking at, and how does that relate to vision as a whole?
Well, we've been interested, I kind of divide our research up into two areas. I'll continue talking about the retina first. We've been very interested in a disease called age-related macular degeneration that a lot of people have heard of. And it is the leading cause of blindness in the elderly in the developed world. So it's actually a significant problem in the United States now, with loss of vision in older people. And one of the ways that it manifests itself is that this process of regenerating the photoreceptors doesn't work 100% correctly, and the back of the eye tends to accumulate some debris, probably the easiest way to describe it, it's sort of like molecular garbage that builds up in the back of the eye.
This is behind the retina.
In the backmost part, I guess is the way to put it. The very, very back of the retina is where it builds up.
Okay.
And there are a number of people have hypothesized a number of things that this material can do. One is it can just be a mechanical stress on the tissue. Another is that it's able to interact with light that's coming into the eye and cause damage that way. And also just through chemistry, that it can cause some unwanted chemical reactions to occur that damage the tissue. And we spent a lot of time looking at all these different possibilities with these materials. And I guess originally, if I tell you a little bit about the other aspect of our research program, you'll see how there's a connection there. So the other thing that we've been very interested in and studied for a number of years is how the optics of the eye change with age. So, for instance, the cornea, that clear tissue on the front part of the eye, together with a lens that's directly behind it, are what focus light back onto the retina. So that's how you actually sense the incoming light signals and begin to form that signal that goes to the brain. So as you age, those different components tend to change a little bit. I guess we're familiar with they aren't as flexible as they when you get to middle age. They're not as flexible as they were when you were younger. And that's why a lot of people
like my fingers.
Right, and people start to need reading glasses, and that's because of that reduction in flexibility. But also the portion of the visible light spectrum that's transmitted to the retina changes as you get older. So, you know, the visible spectrum, what we use that mnemonic of Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, those colors as they get to the eye.
For me, it's Richard of York gave battle in vain. So it's a little piece of English history, but it's the same
idea.
Same letters, but just easier to remember. Richard of York gave battle in vain.
I'll start using that one. I always liked Roy G. Biv is the way we remembered it. And then when I was in school, there was a joke that he had a Russian cousin, and it was Vib Gyor. So going the other direction.
Okay.
So that the part of that spectrum that gets to the retina changes with age, and we've looked at that and with aging, and then also with the primary or one of the major blinding disorders that occurs in that front part of the eye is cataract development,
And what is a cataract?
A cataract is when the lens is kind of it's directly behind that colored part of your eye, the iris. And it's basically a little bag filled with protein that is, it can change its shape, so it can change the focal point, so you can get vision, whether or not you're looking at a distance or close up. And as you age, well, let me just say that the lens is really peculiar in that it's a completely closed system, so the material that is there from birth is there when you die. There's not really any turnover. So any kind of changes that happen inside the lens stick with you for the rest of your life. So as you get older, that material starts to stiffen, and it actually undergoes color changes. It turns kind of a yellow color and eventually brown. And when it gets fairly hard and dark, it's called a cataract. And you know the word cataract actually is used to describe a waterfall, right? And so it's like having a veil over your eye. And here, you know, in the United States or in developed countries, a cataract can be removed surgically. In fact, it's one of the most common surgeries done with a fairly low incidence of problems.
And you simply replace the lens with an artificial plastic lens.
There's a plastic implant that's put in place of that natural lens. And we got involved in this area of research because of our interest in the way that spectrum of light changes as you get older.
We'll come back to that because the concept of you just got a fixed amount of material to begin with and from birth. I mean, there's a certain growth. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. My guest today is Professor Beth Galliard from the Department of Chemistry at Northern Illinois University. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Okay, here's a cheery task. Make a list of conditions that could predict a person's death in 5 years.
How grim, but okay. Cancer, stroke, congestive heart failure, emphysema, and kidney failure.
Now you can add anosmia.
Really? The loss of smell?
I know, right? A new study found losing our sense of smell is a predictor of death in older people. They asked about 3,000 people ages 57 to 85 to identify five common scents. 5 years later, the same people were called and reassessed.
Some of the older seniors had died, and surprisingly, 40% of them had failed the scent test 5 years earlier. So their mortality rate was three times higher than those with healthy noses, even after other factors were ruled out, such as nutrition, mental health, smoking, and alcohol.
So why is the olfactory or sense of smell a predictor of impending death? This ancient ability is tied to good health and nutrition, warns us of environmental hazards, and is intimately tied to memory and emotions.
Normal olfactory function is unique in that it relies on cellular regeneration of the olfactory neuroepithelium and the hippocampus. Thus, olfactory dysfunction can result in the inhibition of stem cell turnover in the olfactory tissue. Could this indicate a problem with cellular regeneration reflecting a larger problem?
The study doesn't answer this and many other questions. It certainly does not mean anosmia causes death, but rather it could be a sign of health problems that directly affect longevity.
If you're concerned, there's a simple scent test available. People can use the results to search for interventions that may prolong their lives.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Professor Beth Galliard, and we're at Northern Illinois University, and we're talking about vision. And before we took a break there, Beth, you were saying that we get our little lenses, right, at birth, and that's it. But they grow. So there is some chemical change that's going on within in order to get the growth, presumably.
That's correct.
How does it get nutrient into that lens in order to grow?
There is on the very front of the lens, so facing the front of your face, there's a layer of cells that are still metabolically active, and they can either synthesize materials or take up materials from the surrounding environment and transport them back into the lens.
Is that a two-way process, that old material can come back out through those cells into the eye and off into wherever dead cells go?
Well, interestingly enough, this is actually an area of great debate right now. It's not entirely well understood how the process of things getting in and out works in the lens. And that actually is a kind of a recurring theme in the eye in general, is that it's not well understood, particularly how materials that aren't wanted get back out of the eye.
Because you were saying earlier that there's this buildup of sort of
debris
between the back of the retina and the back of the eye. What damage does that do, or is there a mechanism for removing that? Because presumably that interferes with the retina interaction with the back of the eye.
It does. That's one of the big questions that people are trying to address right now, is it looks as though the material can't get back out of the eye. One thing, the eye is an interesting organ in that you've heard of like the blood-brain barrier, where it's very difficult for certain materials to get into the brain, and that's a problem with developing drugs that would act within the brain. It's the same kind of problem with the eye, in that the eye is very particular about what kind of material it allows to flow into the eye. And it just has to do with the way the immune system is set up in the eye. So it's also true that it's not necessarily easy to transport materials back out of the eye. And so that debris that accumulates in the back of the eye is hard to get rid of. One strategy that people have looked at is there a way to get rid of it, and that might help slow down or improve vision in people who are older. But there still has not been a lot of success in those projects.
So one of the things that one hears about, a lot of people go in for operations on their retina, right? Detached retina seems to be a catchphrase. What does that mean?
A detached retina is, so the retina is a funny piece of tissue. It's very, very thin. It's almost like a piece of tissue paper that lines the back two-thirds of the eye. And so embedded in that thin tissue are the light sensors that you have. It's only physically connected to the back of the eye at one point, actually where the optic nerve leaves the eye and goes to the brain. So there is a body of sort of jelly-like fluid in front of it called the vitreous that holds it in place just by the pressure pushing it against the back of the eye. So when people have a detached retina, what happens is some of that jelly-like substance from the vitreous goes behind the retina and pushes it up.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of comes loose. And typically the way that that's treated is to take a laser and blow a little tiny hole in the retina so that the fluid can come back out.
Oh, it's a very mechanical
Very
process.
Mechanical, yeah.
Just make your life a little sieve. So if you've got a very poorly detached retina, they make several little holes for the fluid to escape?
Mm-hmm.
And how bad does that impair the vision?
Well, as long as if the holes are made, so it's just the very center of the retina where the best light sensing and focus or the visual power comes in. So as long as it's around that area,
it's
not too damaging.
So there's a lot of redundancy in the retina. It's much bigger than it need be?
It is. The retina itself is probably, maybe almost a centimeter diameter.
Right.
But the region that we use to see with is only about a 5-millimeter circle.
Uh-huh. So then when you go in for this puncturing of the retina to make it reattached, I suppose we could say, you would do the pinpricks right around the circumference.
Right, and leave that central part alone.
One has read in the literature that sometimes people go in for cataract surgery and they come out with lenses that are not quite the same as they had before they went in. Some people say, well, they seem too shiny. What is that all about?
Well, what it became apparent, maybe 15 years ago, people were looking at this debris that accumulates in the retina with age, and some of that debris is actually colored, so it interacts with light that's getting into the eye, and it was postulated that that might be causing some damage to the retina, particularly for people who have cataracts removed and the new plastic lenses put in place. That new plastic lens allows light all the way down into the blue part of the visible spectrum to reach the retina. And so the idea was to put some kind of filtering compounds into the replacement lenses that would protect the retina from that light damage. So that happened at the same time that companies were able to develop plastic lenses that weren't just a piece of plastic, but they were actually able to correct for refractive errors. So it'd be like having a contact lens
stuck
inside your eye. Most people nowadays that have cataract surgery after the surgery have 20/20 vision because of the...
So they don't need glasses anymore?
Pretty much not. Some people will need it for reading, but...
Right. Is that pretty permanent? I mean, I know a lot of people have laser surgery on their eyes when they're about 28 because they don't want to wear glasses and they think, so I'm perfect, but it only lasts for 10 years and then
they've got to do it again. That surgery's on the surface,
right,
on the cornea. That doesn't change what goes on in the lens.
So once you've had a cataract removed and the new lens put in, that's for the rest of your
life?
That's
pretty much for the rest of your life,
okay,
because that's an implant that you have.
So go back to the...
Well, so in order to achieve that kind of correction of vision and at the same time put in these filtering compounds that protect the retina, they have to use plastics that have a very high refractive index. This is a way to get the correcting factors in there. But what happens is when you look at that on somebody from outside, what you'll see is sometimes there's almost like a glowing effect. And I had someone contact me who was working for a trade magazine, and she was writing an article about these new, they call them blue blocking lenses. And she told me that she'd had them implanted, and her grandchildren were afraid of her because her eyes looked like they were glowing, and they thought that grandma looked like a vampire.
So there must be then, within this material they put in there, some fluorescent material, something that some when you irradiate, it itself irradiates back out.
Back out, that's right. Some of the filtering compounds have a little bit of fluorescence to them.
Presumably the manufacturers have corrected this, or are there still glow-in-the-dark eyes out there?
Some of them have changed the filter compounds they use, but interestingly enough, from what I understand, there's a trend of going back to the lenses that don't have the filter compounds.
All right. But you don't want to appear too scary to your grandchildren.
Right.
Or your class if you're a teacher.
Well, and see, and the worst part of it is that the blue blocking lenses, because it blocked the blue part of the spectrum, the fluorescence looked a little bit yellowish. So that gave it an even more ghoulish characteristic.
That's not nice at all. We don't have a long time left, but I know that one of the features that you're very active in, Beth, is something what we will call a STEM cafe. This is something to sort of bring science to the lay public. Would you care to talk about that for a few minutes?
Oh, I'd love to tell you about this. This is one of my favorite sort of fun activities that I get to do here. So I'm the director of the Center for Biochemical and Biophysical Studies, which is a center on campus that brings together researchers who are interested in biomedical problems. And we have gotten together with NIU's STEM outreach, so science, technology, engineering, math outreach program, to put together STEM cafes. And these are usually once a month events that we hold at a local pub or tavern. And we have a member, either a scientist from NIU or somebody local who comes and talks about their particular field in science, sort of gives a 30-minute expert synopsis of what the coolest, latest thing is going on. And
is this with slides and PowerPoints or just purely oral?
Most people will use a few PowerPoint slides as props, but okay. It's very, very informal.
Right.
The ones that I've either given myself or attended and watched people, it's very much walking around, the crowd, talking to people.
A lot of times, not individually.
I mean, right, as a group. So it would be a group of people sitting in the
and then you walk
at the tables
chatting.
In the bar, and you can walk around and chat.
Sounds like fun.
It's an awful lot of fun.
Who comes? Who's the audience for this?
Well, interestingly, it seems to be more of just the general public who want to come and
an excuse
really
to have a drink.
An excuse to have a beer.
Yes, my dear. I'm off to the pub, but it's a science lecture.
It's intellectual, right?
I love it. Beth Galliard, Professor of Chemistry, Northern Illinois University. Thank you so much for being here today. It's been a lot of fun, and I've learned a lot of things.
Well, thank you, Keith. I appreciate you inviting me to talk to you.
Yeah. And I'd like to thank Carl Nelson. He's one of the engineers here at WNIJ DeKalb, Illinois, for helping put this together. And I also thank Norma Martinez, who does, of course, the final editing so that it's worth listening to. Thank you very much, and we hope that you come and listen to us next week on Science Studio. Bye-bye.